From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a law professor looks at the climate surrounding abortion law as the Supreme Court likely takes a conservative turn in the coming months.
Later, the Milwaukee Public Museum tries to avert a building crisis by planning for a new campus to house its enormous collection.
What's really important to us is whatever we do, we bring along what makes the public museum special. You could build a great new museum somewhere in downtown Milwaukee that would be a great museum for any other city, but Milwaukeeans would come there and say, oh, this is terrible. It doesn't feel anything like the public museum that I love.
And ahead of her appearances at the state fair, garden expert Melinda Myers talks about why it's been a rough summer for the plants we like, but a great summer for the ones we hate.
A lot of the weeds are heat tolerant, drought tolerant, and then we get the moisture at just the right time and they take off, so the weeds have a chance to take over.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The issue of reproductive rights is back at the forefront with the retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. President Donald Trump has nominated conservative federal judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill Kennedy's seat.
And with a new, potentially more conservative balance on the court, whether Kavanaugh is confirmed or not, analysts are thinking about whether Roe v. Wade and the choice-friendly cases that came after it could be overturned.
One of the cases that supports Roe, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, protects a woman's right to an abortion before fetal viability. That's defined as when a fetus would survive outside the womb.
Marquette University law professor Peter Rofus explains to Lake Effect's Mayon Silver how the Kennedy retirement could affect reproductive rights.
Two things. One, neither I nor anyone else truly knows what the future of abortion law will hold. It's possible the court will continue to chip away. It's possible the court will overturn Roe and Casey. It's even possible that the court will refrain from a fundamental change in the constitutional law of abortion.
If the court were to take that step and overturn Roe or Casey, or both of them, what would happen in Wisconsin?
A mighty fine question about which people are currently debating, contesting, and disagreeing. In the mid-19th century, right in the middle of the 19th century, Wisconsin passed a law common of state laws in the 19th century that essentially forbade all abortions with exceptions, but essentially rendered abortion against the law. What happens if the reconstituted court dramatically changes the law of the constitutional law of abortion is one of two things, each of which will involve a substantial amount of litigation. One is litigants will test whether any of the pre-Roe Wisconsin case law forbidding abortion gets, if you will, revitalized, springs back to life, reinvigorated, and whether a statewide ban on abortion from the mid-19th century is brought back into existence. The other thing, of course, that could happen is a series of new laws that a legislature constituted in a particular way and a governor's mansion occupied in a particular way would pass to take account of what you've referred to as the overturning of Roe. A third possibility, perhaps the least likely in our state, is that very little happens in light of the overturning of Roe.
In that situation that very little happens, would that 19th century law be in effect?
Neither I nor anyone else, anybody who purports to know the answer to that, it probably isn't telling you the truth. What would happen is that a court or multiple courts in all likelihood would seek to answer that question. We are not a state, unlike for others, we are not a state with a so-called trigger law that would have our ban on abortion immediately spring back within a certain number of days after a certain legal development occurs. And that's why I cannot tell you with any certainty, and candidly, I don't believe anybody can tell you with very much certainty what is going to happen in our state, what the legal status of abortion would be the day after, say, Roe and or Casey are taken off the books.
Do you know what that decision-making would look like that period after, let's say, the Supreme Court changes the federal law so that states' laws govern? What would happen in Wisconsin? I mean, what would you anticipate would happen?
I anticipate a huge amount of political activity, the result of which will depend on, in the aftermath of redistricting, which we've had, will depend on what political party controls the legislature and what political party controls the governor's mansion. So if a political party opposed to abortion and reproductive rights has the political power to do so, then I would think it would be relatively an easy prediction that Wisconsin would seek to reenact, say, something along the lines of the mid-19th century prohibition. However, if there were not a veto-proof legislature and or if a Democrat was in the governor's mansion, the aftermath of that Supreme Court decision could be very, very different.
And who would be the major players in deciding that besides the legislature?
We would have litigants. We would have the legislature. We would have the governor. We, of course, would have the enforcement mechanisms. We would have the attorney general and DAs and ADAs around the state who would be the ones seeking to prosecute any potential violation, essentially by going after physicians or healthcare providers. There is, as you may know, a Wisconsin law that essentially says, almost verbatim, women, pregnant women who choose abortion are generally not to be subject to the abortion law. So in a sense, most of Wisconsin's laws apply to physicians who perform abortions and others, but generally the mother is given a legal out in the Wisconsin statutes. Not in every case, but in the vast bulk of cases.
And so the law, what it mostly does, the one that's on the books now, the pre-law, Roe law, it criminalizes for the providers.
Correct.
Are there any exceptions to those laws, and what are they?
There is the language about the life or health of the mother in that 1849 law. I do not recall offhand other exceptions. I'm going to read you a sentence from that 1849 statute. Every person who shall administer to any pregnant woman with a quick child any medicine, drug, or substance, whatever, or et cetera, with intent to destroy such child, unless the same shall have been necessary to preserve the life of such mother, or shall have been advised by two physicians to be necessary for such purpose, shall be deemed guilty of manslaughter in the second degree. That's the law from the mid-19th century.
Does the Attorney General or the DA have to enforce abortion law in the case that Wisconsin makes it criminal to provide an abortion?
Okay, I think it's important to understand the role that prosecutorial discretion plays in our system. It's present in the most basic traffic laws and speeding infractions, where law enforcement officials decide whom to pull over to the side of the road rather than pull over everyone speeding or everyone who might have a headlight or a taillight that is out. In the event actions of the nation's highest court produce circumstances in which, by virtue of state law currently on the books or state law that is placed on the books in the aftermath of those developments, it will then our attentions will need to be turned to the Attorney General's office, the State Department of Justice, DAs around the state, and in the event that the governor and the attorney general are of the same party, it's almost certain that the governor would play a role in determining how to enforce the prohibitions that end up on the books. So there will be decisions made, and it's all part of what's called prosecutorial discretion. Against whom should the mechanism of state power be directed when a law is broken? How often? In what context? So, yes, in general, we expect law enforcement officials to enforce the law. But we know that certain laws fall into non-enforcement. And that's been present around the country in a host of areas.
What if you get, let's say, a Democratic AG and a Republican governor, and these laws are criminalizing abortion, that type of thing?
We've seen circumstances like that, by the way, in our own state, where going back, not a perfect analog, but if you recall, when Attorney General Jim Doyle was AG and Governor Thompson was governor, certain issues were taken from the AG and moved to the governor's office. For instance, the defense of the school choice program. There were concerns on the part of a Republican governor and others around him that a Democratic attorney general would be insufficiently vigorous in the defense of the nation's first school choice law. So it is possible. It's even likely in states where the gubernatorial office and the AG's office are in different hands, different political party hands, that there will be disputes about the enforcement of laws forbidding abortion if and when those laws become the constitutional power of the state. It's hard to predict the landscape down the road, even if it's only a couple of years or 5 or 10. But you can be certain with the facts you posited, either a Democratic governor and a Republican AG, or flip it, that there will be a sort of tug of war, a power struggle with regard to how vigorously to enforce the laws that might once again become vibrant and, if you will, literally on the books in Wisconsin.
Basically, what you're saying is how these laws would interact is something that would be the subject of intense challenges and political action and work on the part of many different parties. Is that correct?
Right, in this state, and we would be seeing this, except in those trigger states, we would be seeing this process play out at the state level in 46 states around the nation. That's correct.
Do you see that because Wisconsin has these laws on the books that haven't been overturned in Wisconsin, that that would lead the discussion or lead the movement in one direction?
I think there are those folks who believe that by not repealing that mid-19th century law, that's the eventuality you describe, the phenomenon you describe, is more likely to occur. I'm not at all certain. The way to ensure that your laws against abortion kick in immediately after a legal development, such as a court overturning Roe and Casey, is to put that in the statute, is to have a trigger law in your state. For all we know, it may well be that, who knows, maybe in the next X number of months or in the next year, a year and a half, such trigger law may happen in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin legislature, the lawmaking process in Wisconsin, has been active in this area in the same way that the vast bulk of states' legislatures and governors' mansions have been active, regulating parental consent, regulating who's allowed to perform abortions, regulating, in some cases, there was a Wisconsin law that had to do with the location of a physician's office to where a particular abortion procedure was to be performed. So the Wisconsin legislature has been active for the last 3 decades in passing laws of all sorts having to do with abortion, absolutely. And some of those laws remain vibrant, active, enforceable. Others have been invalidated, both by state courts or by federal courts.
And the ones we're talking about that are actually pre-Roe, you're saying those are not necessarily enforceable, or there would just be a lot of litigation and politics before they could become enforceable?
What I'm saying is
Correct. I would not be able to give to a client. Legal advice is a matter of risk. We say that to clients all the time. I'd be cautious about giving to a client advice about whether, say, an 1849 Wisconsin law suddenly becomes law once again if the nation's highest court a year or two or three from now overturns Roe, Casey, and returns abortion to the states. That's correct.
Thank you so much for speaking about this.
Thanks for asking.
Peter Rofus is a professor at Marquette University Law School. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. You can find more coverage of abortion issues and the U.S. Supreme Court from links at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break and then learn more about the Milwaukee Public Museum's effort to plan, fund, and build a new museum campus. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Downtown Milwaukee, in case you haven't noticed, has been undergoing a building boom in recent years. From completed projects like the Northwestern Mutual Tower and the newly named Fiserv Forum to ones that are just underway, like the BMO Harris Tower on Water Street.
The changes have affected the city's cultural facilities as well. The Oriental Theater is undergoing major renovations under its new ownership. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra is at work on renovating the Grand Theater as its new venue. And the Milwaukee Art Museum built a new addition, which opened not that long ago, to ease a then-looming crisis in storing its vast collection.
The Milwaukee Public Museum is dealing with a similar issue in the space it's occupied for more than 50 years. The museum announced several months ago it's starting the planning process to build and move to a new facility. More recently, museum leaders unveiled some design concepts as they plan for how to fund the project. Dennis Coyce is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much for having me back, Mitch.
So I think anyone who has been to the Milwaukee Public Museum in recent years has been actually pretty impressed by the state of things, the upgraded streets of old Milwaukee, the traveling exhibits like the Mayan Civilization exhibit. Walking through the building, I don't know that the casual observer would sense that anything is anything but just fine. So why do you see this as such a pivotal time for the museum?
Well, so I think, you know, that's a great point. And our visitors do, I think, see a, you know, an institution they love and they care about. But behind the scenes, we've got a staff of heroes, I would say, who are working really hard to protect the collections that we hold in the public trust, those 4 million specimens and artifacts and objects that are irreplaceable and you can't place a value on those. The staff are working hard behind the scenes to protect those, and they're protecting them from the failures of the building and a facility that really has outlived its useful life. And that's not the fault of anyone. The museum has worked hard to maintain the facility. The county has worked hard to maintain it. But those staff are fighting every day to protect those collections from, problems that the building wreaks on them. You know, those are...
Right. What are we talking about here?
We are talking about, water leaks from six-year-old pipes that burst over collections areas. We are talking about mold issues from a building that was not... built to sort of museum standards even in its day, thanks to some value engineering that went on. We were talking about temperature swings. We were talking about, just a range of issues that slowly but surely are degrading and destroying museum collections. And our job as a museum is to care for those collections so that they're around 100, 500, 1,000 years from now, hopefully, for people to research and utilize. And so it's the building itself, I think we've done a good job of keeping up appearances, But ultimately, there's only so far you can go with that. And I think we've figured out and the county's figured out it's time for some changes.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like this is one of those times where the cliche of the tip of the iceberg is really appropriate, or the metaphor that for everything that we see that's on display at a museum, there must be dozens of things that we don't see.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we've got 4 million objects in the collections, give or take. And, you know, of those 4 million, about 8%, I think, is our figure, are on display at any given time. That I might be off by a percent or two there. But it's, you know, it's less than 10%. And the reason for that is not because we would show all 4 million if we could. That could be a really boring museum. There'd be a lot. But it's because the rest of those collections are for research. And the value in them is they are like a living library of life. And so the staff we have behind the scenes, I think the iceberg metaphor is apt. You know, the people behind the scenes, or below the waterline, if you will, are the folks who are doing research on those collections. So they're the people that are partnering up with UWM or Marquette or scientists in upstate Wisconsin looking at, you know, why are bees not pollinating cranberry crops in northern Wisconsin, which is a huge economic issue and a huge, you know, biologic issue, and it's something we're still struggling to understand. The only way you can understand that is to compare bee DNA from 100 years ago to bee DNA collected from that same county today. So that's the stuff that goes on with those collections. We definitely would not show them all, and we don't have a plan to show them all. The future.
Well, so someone might ask then, why is it the role of a museum in the 21st century to do things like that, to be the repository of materials that are being used for research, as opposed to an institution like UW-Madison or Marquette or UWM or any of the institutions upstate?
I think, you know, museums are our culture's way of handling material culture, right? So we are not a repository of books or of knowledge in the sort of abstract sense. We're a repository of these physical, tangible things. So we're the place that doesn't have the story of the meteor that fell to Earth and landed in a farmer's field in Wisconsin. We're the place that has the actual meteor that you can take a slice off of and study, you know, this 4-billion-year-old object that fell from outer space. So, you know, that primary research, that's what museums are there to do and to facilitate. And that's what those collections are so good for.
You said the museum and the county and everybody involved has done its best to try to deal with what it has. How long has this situation been building where the museum is really, the building is outliving its usefulness?
You know, it's one of those things I think it takes a while for everyone to sort of scratch their head and say, you know, what are the challenges we're facing and why do we need to address this? I think, you know, for the museum, this dates back probably to the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee. That great bipartisan organization did a report back in 2012 that quantified that the museum had at that point $30 million of deferred capital maintenance. So that's, you know, escalators that haven't been fixed, it's systems that haven't been able to be fixed, it's roofs that leak, all those kinds of things. And I think that's what got the museum starting to think about, is this facility really the right facility for us long term? And the more we looked into that and thought about that, the more we realized there are issues there beyond even just its care, but things like, is it the right facility for the kinds of technology museums need to use now and into the future? You know, could we renovate it? You know, I mean, we're a frugal organization. We're not going to try and do anything new unless we say, could we actually just take what we have and make it better? And so we looked at that. We looked at all kinds of options. But ultimately, you know, for a variety of reasons, moving into new facilities is clearly the path for us.
Are there already objects that have been compromised by the condition that the building is in?
So what I would say is there have certainly been objects that have been damaged by the condition, the facility itself. And we are very lucky in that we have a really talented staff and a really talented team. I would put our emergency response team up against any museum's emergency response team, which is not something you really want to talk about in the museum world because it implies a certain problem.
That there are emergencies.
But our team is really good. And so they have been able to rescue materials that have been damaged. You know, an example I would give you is we have this amazing collection of WPA-era women's work quilts from the 1920s that the museum has had. And they're beautiful, and they all relate to Milwaukee families and Milwaukee history. They're all made here in the community. And we had a 50-year-old pipe burst that had kind of like a sludgy, greasy, you know, drain trap kind of a mess fall all over these quilts and, you know, stain them. And you know, we had a response team that went in there, you know, rolled them up, froze them to keep the liquid from percolating further through them. They all had to be sent to Chicago. They were conserved. Luckily, they were all saved. They all look as good as new. But it was a huge labor-intensive project, a huge expense. And, you know, it's just not what you want to see happening in a museum. museum. So those kinds of things are what are giving us pause and saying it's time. Something's got to be changed.
Would you compare the situation in a way to what the art museum was dealing with before it built its new facility?
I think absolutely the case. You know, museums are held to a certain standard in the museum world to be accredited, to call themselves a museum. And only 5% of the museums in the United States are accredited, just like a hospital or a university is accredited. And we're accredited. And we want to make sure we keep that accreditation. And just like the art museum, they have the same challenges with some of the issues of their facilities. They needed to make some changes to keep their accreditation, keep on the right path, and we need to do that too.
How does public ownership of the museum both enhance and complicate the process of seeking a new space?
I think for us, I see it only as a positive. And from the standpoint, yes, it is more complicated from the sense of we are truly a public institution. And so I think having a public voice in our process is really, really important for us. We want to hear from the visitors. We want to hear from government officials. We need to understand what the state thinks, the county thinks, the mayor thinks, our donors, and then the visiting public. And so, on some level, yes, that's more complicated than if we were just a private nonprofit and we could say, we really only care about what our donors think. But ultimately, it's also going to lead to a better outcome because it's going to create something that reflects what the community wants and also reflects some reality of what's sustainable for Milwaukee. And I think that's a challenge in Milwaukee that a lot of nonprofits are grappling with and we as a community are grappling with, is how to create sustainable long-term trajectories for some of these institutions in our community that we all care about, whether it's the domes or the public museum or the symphony. How do you make sure those things are sustained and cared for over the course of a long period of time that, exceeds our lifetimes? I think, a public process is going to help us make sure that what we come to is going to do that.
You mentioned the state, and we think of this as the Milwaukee Public Museum, but you make the case that the state at large benefits from the museum and that the state ought to play a role in the financing for a new facility. Explain what that means. Why is this more than either a city of Milwaukee or a Milwaukee County issue and is more of a, involves the state?
I would absolutely argue that it does involve the state. And I would argue, in fact, that, the name of the museum, the Milwaukee Public Museum, is a little bit of a misnomer. I mean, I'm proud to be a Milwaukeean and have this place, but fundamentally, it's Wisconsin's Natural History Museum. It's Wisconsin's public museum. It's the only major research-based natural history museum in the state, doing original research behind the scenes with collections of anywhere close to that scale. That research benefits the whole state. So, I mentioned earlier, research on cranberry crops and the economics of that for our state. We are training museum professionals through the museum studies program we run with UWM that go out and work in historic societies and institutions all over the state. We have collections from every county. We have visitors from every county, and I think impact the state on a really wide basis. There is nothing else like it in our state. And in fact, I'd point out, that a lot of nearby states would love to have a major research-based natural history museum. There isn't one on this scale in Minnesota. There isn't one on this scale in Michigan. So it's a really unique resource that Milwaukee and Wisconsin has, and we really want to make sure we keep it. So I think, it is Wisconsin's Natural History Museum. It's going to have to be thought of on a statewide level. And I think our fundraising is going to have to be thought of on a statewide level. And ultimately, very few major institutions like MPM create new facilities without some mechanism of state-level support. And so we're really making that case in Madison.
You have taken the steps of releasing some design concepts. How should we view that effort at this stage, considering that the financial framework is not yet in place?
I think, what you can read into those efforts, those are concepts in the true sense that what the building's going to look like may not be anything like what those concepts look like, because that may not be the architect we, in fact, end up using. But we were really excited to work with Matt Rinka at Rinka Chung. He was generous enough to donate his services because he grew up running around the museum and pressing the snake button. And, what they are for us is kind of a philosophical, premise, if you will, of what do we want this thing to look like and feel like. And for us, the things I would read into it, if I was looking at those as a member of the public, are, we want it to be transparent and feel like it's of the streetscape. We want it to be a really nice piece of architecture. We don't want it to be a closed box and feel closed to the street and closed to the world. It's about kind of opening up knowledge and ideas. I think we want it to be family friendly. We want it to be on public transportation networks. We need it to work as a business for us. So things like parking revenue and event space and things are important to us to make sure it's sustainable for those long-term issues. So I think you can kind of read it as like sort of philosophical statement of intent, but it's not the literal thing that we are going to create at this point.
One cannot help but look at that and say, this looks like it is on top of Veterans Park.
That is actually not where it's going to go. I can state that with some certainty. I'm sure to the relief of veterans and probably the art museum, too. It is not what we intend. We did release a different concept that a particular architecture firm, Zimmerman Studios, also did gratis very graciously. But they picked that site and designed for that site as kind of a thought exercise for their own teams and then shared that with us. So that doesn't imply that that's where we're going to go. We are still looking at sites around the city.
Downtown is important, though.
Downtown is important. We've been downtown for 150 years, I think downtown is important to us. So we've identified sort of a range of how far from downtown we would be willing to go, but it's not very far. And we're looking at a range of sites and evaluating those against the kinds of criteria we have for accessibility and a part of town that our audience feels welcome and that you can get to on public transport and school kids can get to and all the, you know, all those kinds of things that we need to have work for us.
Is there a certain importance in having it close to the other iconic museums of Milwaukee, the Art Museum, Discovery World, the things in that part of the city?
You can make, I think, a case for and a case against those kinds of cultural campuses. Anyone who's been down to Chicago and experienced the lakefront campus of museums down there, you know, that's a great experience and a great idea. There's also some interesting research that talks about the fact that those kinds of campus, build-outs create situations where the visitor, you know, your public will kind of tend to go to one institution a year and say, okay, well, I've been down to the cultural campus this year. Next year, we'll do the other museum and the other one after that. Whichever way you go, I think, you know, the lakefront's still, a place we're going to look, and it's not specifically Veterans Park. It's other parts of the lakefront. But there are other parts of downtown as well that I think are important. So for us, it's more important that it serve our audience and what our audience wants than that it is tied to other cultural institutions specifically.
This would be, I think, the fifth space for the museum in its history. Is it too much to ask a museum to commit to someplace being its forever home, for lack of a better term?
I think it's tough to ask anybody to commit to this being your forever home. And I think any homeowner would put it to that, right? Your situation changes, your needs change, so eventually we all end up moving in our lives over time, But it is, I think that fact alone does surprise some people in the community. I think a lot of people think of it, if they grew up coming to the museum in the, 60s and 70s, they think, oh, it's always been down there. And they're surprised to learn that there's a whole nother batch of Milwaukeeans who remember it being in what's now the public library downtown. And I don't know there's many people left alive that remember it before that, but it had multiple homes before that in other parts of downtown. So, these are living institutions. It's going to have a vibrant future life. And I think what's really important to us is whatever we do, we bring along what makes the public museum special. You could build a great new museum somewhere in downtown Milwaukee that would be a great museum for any other city, but Milwaukeeans would come there and say, oh, this is terrible. It doesn't feel anything like the public museum that I love. The public museum has a special kind of weird gestalt to it, weird vibe to it. And we've got to make sure we bring that into the future. So the snake button and the streets and the things that people love, the best of those do come with us. And that feeling comes with us. But it's got to be a contemporary institution.
Who owns the space that the building is in now, and how might the disposal of that space help finance a new space? And I guess that's that's the end of that question.
That's a good question.
Right. How could the current space contribute to the creation of a new space?
Absolutely. So the building that we are in now is owned by Milwaukee County, as is the land under it, in essence. And there's a few parts of the museum that technically the museum owns, but they all revert to the county if we were to vacate that site. So it becomes the county's site to then figure out what to do with. And the county is doing a lot of planning around MacArthur Square and what needs to happen there with a courthouse and other kinds of facilities. So I think they're thinking about this within the larger context or what they need to do, but there's no immediate cash cow you can look at and say, oh, we could sell that to turn it into a 40-story hotel complex and use that to finance a new museum. There's no path on that. Ultimately, it is public land, and it will be put to public use as the county supervisors and the county executives see fit. So I wish there were a path on that, but there's not.
If I understand correctly, you're hoping to break ground on the new facility by 2022. Look at the next 6 months. What is in motion that you want to accomplish between, say, now and the end of the year?
I'd say, over the coming months, what you're going to see, without giving any hard deadlines yet, but, we are really intensely looking at site. What is the right location for this? Because ultimately, that's got to lead everything else. You can't design for a site you don't have. You can't fundraise for a site you don't have. So site and where it goes downtown, I think, is probably priority number one. Priority number two is really making the case at the state level that the museum and the public that uses the museum and our state state is worthy of having this institution, is worthy of state-level support. And I'm really encouraged by the support the state is putting behind the State Historic Society in Madison. You know, that is an institution that is also statewide, just like MPM. And the state has committed and said, we will put $70 million into a new museum in Madison for the State Historic Society if the society can raise $50 million. And that's on top of them putting about $47 million into collection storage for the Historic Society. You know, and that is for an institution that gets about half the visitors or less than we do, and for a collection that is, you know, sort of physically about half the size, I think, give or take, of what we have. You know, and so I'm hopeful that the state will choose to make that kind of investment and we'll find a path forward. And I think we're hearing really good, thoughtful feedback from the state, and we're trying to make sure we find a solution that works for everybody.
Dennis Coyce, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
Dennis Coyce is president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. You can see some of the renderings of design concepts for a new museum campus at WUWM.com.
The Wisconsin State Fair builds up and tears down every year at the State Fair Park in West Allis. With this year's fair just underway, we chat with gardening contributor Melinda Myers about the kinds of things she's going to chat with fairgoers about this summer as the Lake Effect continues after a short break on 89.7 WUWM. Of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Wisconsin State Fair began its nearly two-week run today in West Allis. Tens of thousands of people will take in concerts, check out the farm animals, take rides on the Midway, and eat profoundly unhealthy foods between now and August 12th.
Many of them will also stop by the We Energies Energy Park for a chance to chat with gardening expert Melinda Myers, who also happens to be a Lake Effect contributor. If you just can't wait, though, for her daily appearances, Melinda Myers stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk about what's on her and other gardeners' minds this summer. Welcome back to the show. Long time no see.
Exactly. It's always great to be here and talk to you and your listeners about gardening.
And as we have this conversation, the Wisconsin State Fair is getting underway, and you are at the fair more often than you're not at the fair, I think. It's a tiring 10 days or so for you. But let's start with what you're expecting to hear from people when they talk to you at the fair this year.
You know, I think this has been quite the challenging year. And I know we say that every year, gardening in Wisconsin or the weather, wait 5 minutes and it changes. But I've talked to a lot of gardeners who are very frustrated. You know, we had a lot of rain early. I remember making an appearance the end of April and it was 22 degrees when I got up. And less than a month later, it was 97 degrees. And some of us got a lot of rain in the beginning and not so much later. And those high temperatures have taken their toll on a lot of plants and a lot of gardeners. I mean, I think a lot of people have just been very frustrated, you know. Things are doing great or they're not doing well at all.
And it's interesting because I must have hit the gardening jackpot this year and put the plants in just the right type of plants at just the right time, because it seemed like as soon as I got them in the ground, they were going crazy. And then I've heard from other people how frustrated they've been. And, you know, I'm not sure I did anything different than usual. The thing that's really struck me this year is how many weeds I have growing along with the cucumbers and the peppers and
well,
such.
I think it has been a great weed year. And I think that's the other frustration. I know I feel like I've spent way more time weeding than ever before. And you're right. I was out of town working and my potatoes were looking really good. And I came and the weeds were just very tiny. And I came back 3 days later and I couldn't see the potatoes. And I've weeded that bed three times this year.
Well, so why is it such a good year for weeds, but not necessarily such a good year for anything else?
You know, I think the heat has been great. A lot of those weeds that are popping up, like purslane, and I know everybody quoted the article about you can eat it. And so you may want to do that. That may be your best harvest. But a lot of the weeds are heat tolerant, drought tolerant. And then we get the moisture at just the right time and they take off. And then if our other plants are a little more sensitive about temperature or moisture, they're not doing quite as well, so the weeds have a chance to take over. And we do want to keep the weeds under control. That's the question I hear a lot.
I was going to ask
is it worth it? I'm still getting a couple tomatoes. Well, weeds compete for water and nutrients. They also shade plants. So like vine crops, like your cucumbers, your squash, your melons can get powdery mildew, that white substance on the leaves. So if you have a lot of weeds, they block the light, they block the airflow, which increases the risk of powdery mildew. Many are hosts for disease and insects. So if you have the weed growing by a plant that's susceptible to the same disease or insect, you're bringing them in and giving them plenty of food or plenty of plants to infect.
So this is they're like the gateway.
I haven't thought of it that way, but exactly. And I keep telling people, keep weeding, even though, you know, you're like, oh, you know, I'm just so tired of weeding. But every weed you pull is 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 fewer that you'll have next year. And it's not too late to mulch your garden. I was working on the garden at Energy Park where I speak, and, you know, there were a few leaves, and we were like, where'd those leaves come from? I said, put them in the garden because they make great mulch. You know, shred them up with your mower if they're large, spread them on the soil. Areas I had mulched last year, had lot fewer weeds this year. The soil's improving as those leaves break down. It does a lot of good things.
I was not going to ask this question until I heard you talking about it in the lobby of this radio station just a few minutes ago, but it strikes me that we cannot both be the only people in this issue. It is a big challenge to keep lilacs under control.
Oh, it is. We are redoing our deck, and I use that term loosely, the royal we. And I had a lot of lilacs that I think people put right up against the house before they sold it to make it look beautiful. The lilacs in just 5 years have quadrupled in size, were overflowing the deck, so they needed to be moved. Plus, they were shadowing the deck, holding in the moisture, and I was going to move them. I'm a horticulturist. But we decided to pull one out using our tractor. Thank goodness we had it. And it about tipped the tractor. And I looked at the root ball and thought, there is no way I can move this plant effectively. And it killed me. They will be wood chips in my garden paths, but it killed me to do that. But at some point, you do have to say, you know what? It's better to start over, repurpose this as wood chips, because digging and moving, I'm probably not going to be successful. Now, I'm not saying—
And there's no just cutting it back so far that it's—
You can try. Now, if I'd planned well, I could have started it in fall, do some root pruning, and then move it in spring. But I'd been thinking about moving these for a year, so obviously that didn't happen. Good intentions. So you can do a little pre-planning, but at some point you have to say, could I manage a 16-inch diameter root ball that's 12 inches deep? That's what I'd need to do. And that's heavy. And then if I dig it and drop it, I've broken the root ball and probably ruined the plant. So you have to really look at, you know, the logistics. Are you going to have any friends after you ask for the help? And, you know, and I'm not saying don't give it a try, because I've moved stuff that I probably shouldn't have, sometimes was successful. But, you know, at other times I go, cut my losses and start over.
And the moral of the story here is that lilacs grow pretty darn quickly.
Oh, they do. And that was a dwarf lilac, which we all think of, but it gets a good 6 feet tall. And like you said, it sends out all those shoots, which was beautiful and smelled great in the spring, but it was a good 6 feet in diameter and a lot of stems to try to manage and a lot of weight to try to deal with.
And in our yard, a lot of the same with Russian sage and a lot of the same with the smoke bush we have in the corner of the yard.
You know, and I have to admit, I planted a lot of struggling shrubs that have recovered greatly and need to be moved. And I will move those this fall because they're still a manageable size. And that's kind of the lesson to learn. Perennials a lot easier to move than trees and shrubs. So, you know, one of the things, if you're thinking of transplanting fall after the leaves drop, look at the size of root ball, do some root pruning, and then next spring, if those roots are in that area, that trench that you've dug, you might want to dig the root ball a little bit bigger, because what you're doing is stimulating roots inside that area so you have a better chance of success. That's for those people who are good at planning ahead.
What is the theme this year that you're working with at the State Fair?
Green and growing. So things that can help you be successful and have fun in your garden while being kind to the environment. Because I think we all want to do the right thing, but if it's too hard or too complicated, well, you know, I just don't have time or I don't know how to do it. So simple things like mulching, like we talked about, shredding your leaves, evergreen needles. I had somebody that was cleaning the needles out from under their tree, not sure why, ask if I wanted them. I'm like, yeah, that's free mulch. I put those under my apple trees, and so it's been great. It keeps the weeds down and improved the soil. Tips for watering. We have a new thing called a storm garden, and it's kind of like a rain barrel rain garden in one. It's a beautiful raised bed, and we're demonstrating this of how you can collect water from your roof, grow water plants, and then it eventually will go into your rain garden. So it manages stormwater and keeps it where it falls.
This is almost a vertical kind of, it's certainly using gravity.
Yes, exactly. So you've got the downspout going into this raised bed, picture a raised bed, but it collects water instead of holding a lot of soil. So I'm very excited to show that off and give people some creative ideas, especially if you have a small space, you're in a city lot, and your neighbors may not appreciate rain barrels, which you can hide them just like you do your trash cans. But if you don't have room, this might be a good alternative.
It's beginning of August. We are starting to think about what's going to come later. But the temperatures have been pretty consistent recently. We have not had really cold weather. We have not had super warm weather. Maybe this is a nice time for things to grow. Is there anything that you can, and any edibles at this stage of the game, that you could still put in the ground?
Oh, this is a great time. So I just want to encourage people, don't give up. You know, if you gave up, start again. So look at the back of the seed packet. You know, if you look at radishes, it's usually 30, 35 days from planting to harvest. I'm going to put some zucchini in my garden, hopefully today when I get home, and get that going. That takes like 55 or 65 days. So we have August and September, usually frost-free, and a good portion of October. And so look at the back of the seed packet or the plant tag. It says from planting to harvest, and hopefully have a few more weeks to pick. And then I love using floating row cover. So if we get an unexpected early frost, I just throw this fabric over, anchor it. I can leave it in place till I'm ready to harvest because it lets air, light, and water through. So it's a very easy way to extend the season.
Melinda Myers, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Enjoy the state fair. Thanks.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin and the Midwest Gardener's Handbook. She's also a Lake Effect contributor, and she will make twice daily appearances at the Wisconsin State Fair between now and August 12th. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
Are songs out there that we think of as standards. They might have been recorded decades ago, but they are still part of our collective consciousness, whether they show up in the soundtrack of a movie, at a wedding dance, or somewhere else.
We might have heard them so many times, in fact, that we've stopped paying attention to the words, almost allowing them to take on the role of aural wallpaper. Well, Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz has reclaimed one such standard.
I've been on a Frank Sinatra kick of late. Perhaps because I'm having so much fun crooning to my daughter when the house is empty and no one else can hear me. Sorry, neighbors. It's during a particularly rousing rendition of The Way You Look Tonight that I have a revelation. In my mind, this is the quintessential father-daughter wedding dance song. Or maybe I watched Steve Martin and Kimberly Williams dancing in Father of the Bride one too many times circa 1992. In any case, I'm singing this to my daughter and thinking about how she and my husband will be dancing cheek to cheek one day, at least 25 years from now, if she decides to marry. And I'm envisioning her in a beautiful white gown, candles aglow, all eyes on the bride waltzing with her father. And then, whoa, hang on. My mind goes here first. Why does this have to be her father's song? Why don't mothers of the bride get a dance? Why don't we get a song at the wedding? And then I think, why wait 25 years? And so I scoop her up. I let go of the image of a 25-year-old daughter. I breathe in the 5-month-old sweet, sweet baby smells and pull her cheek to mine. We spin around the room with Frank, both giggling at our reflection in the mirror. And suddenly, the words have a new meaning. The way you look tonight becomes this present moment. This moment that is passing by so very quickly. I want to remember the laugh that wrinkles her nose and is actually more of a shriek at 5 months. I want to memorize the smiles that light up her face and express such pure, promise-filled joy. I don't want to forget her little hands that grasp at my shirt and cling to the wisps of hair around my neck. One day, when I'm awfully low, I know I will feel a glow just thinking of her and the way she looks tonight.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz is a mom and a writer who lives on Milwaukee's East Side. You can hear her past contributions at WUWM.com.
With your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you and the way you look tonight.
That is all for Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Just a heads up that next week, just ahead of the primary, is Politics Week on Lake Effect. On Monday, we'll feature the recent GOP Senate debate that we hosted with TMJ4 that featured Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson.
Then Tuesday through Friday, we'll have extended versions of interviews WUWM's Marty Michelson is doing with the Democrats vying for the nomination to run against Governor Scott Walker in the fall. That is all next week on this very show.
Well, thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned, because fresh air comes your way next.
That breathless charm, won't you please arrange it, 'cause I love you just the way.